And one thing that I really learned was how easy they take their easy runs. So it's a real sort of shuffle 10, 12 minute mile pace when these guys can run half marathon at sub 5 minute mile pace easy.
This is Running for Real, the podcast for runners who know that for every runner's high, there are just as many lows. All those just missed PRs, easy runs that feel hard, injury blues, and more. Each week, we'll talk to running, health, and wellness experts about their highs, lows, and best advice to build our confidence. Running for Real is about being honest, being brave, and most of all, not feeling alone. And now here's our host, who once came within touching distance of a whale while out on a paddleboard, Tina Muir.
Hello, my friends. Thank you so much for joining me for this episode 11 of the Running for Real podcast. We have a really unique episode for you today. And, you know, I'm going to go on to talk about it a little bit now, but this is something I don't think anyone has ever done before, or not that I know of, in a running podcast. But before we get to that, so last week was with Amelia Boone, who is an obstacle course racer, but she actually gave a different interview to probably what you would think, because she talked about her struggle from returning from a year of straight injuries. She's really real and authentic with her journey and kind of talking about how much she struggled with the return, the heartbreak of just kind of like going back and forth with injuries, and how we get fearful of returning. We hope that we can get back to where we were. And she was just such a wonderful person. So if you are going through an injury or a bad time, that's definitely one you want to go back and check out. I want to take a moment to thank you so much for subscribing, reviewing the podcast, sharing the podcast, all that you do to help grow it. It really, really means the world. And you are going to hear in a minute that I have actually added sponsors as of this episode. I obviously would love to keep it sponsor-free, but this podcast has grown substantially. And you know, I left my job at Runners Connect to start my own business, and my podcast is, you know, doing really well. And thank you guys so much for helping me with that. But I hope you understand, you know, this is a free podcast and I'm giving you a lot of insights and a lot of advice. And so, you know, these sponsors really help me to make it possible to be able to do this. So I hope you understand and consider visiting their website. You know, that's only going to support me and show them that it's worth their time and money to support this podcast. So I hope you'll consider checking out their products. And if you do, and if you do purchase their products, please let them know that you came from me, and that'll make me look good. So thank you for that. So today we're going to be talking to Tom Payne, who is a British runner. But the reason I wanted to bring him on is because he spent some time living in Kenya. And he lived with the Kenyan runners, he lived as a Kenyan runner, he kind of explains exactly what it's like. And then he kind of talks about the other side of things, talking about what it's like to be an athlete manager, which is what he's doing now, what that involves. So I thought it'd be a really unique glimpse into what life is like as a professional runner, and then also what it's like being the manager of a professional runner. And then we also get into the doping situation. So it's really interesting podcast episode, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. Thank you once again for supporting this podcast. Let's get on with the interview. Smoothies, recovery bowl, bars, cookies, biscotti. What do all of those have in common? Any ideas? You can make them with Generation UCAN. How's that for a win-win? Learn more about Generation UCAN at generationucan.com, and I will give you a coupon code later in the episode for 10% off. Hello, Tom. Thank you so much for joining me for the Running for Real podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I'm excited to have you here, and I want to start off, well, I guess actually I'll start off with the fun fact or hidden talent about you. If there is anything you can think of that maybe people who know you really well know it, but everyone else wouldn't have thought that about you.
Well, something that probably not many people know, people, I guess, that will be listening to this know me as a runner, but I did chemical engineering at university, so yeah. And I worked as a chemical engineer for 7 or 8 years before sort of moving on to more running related things.
Yeah, that makes the transition you did, which we're going to talk about in a minute, even more amazing that you kind of gave up something as like specific and niche and, you know, impressive as that to kind of go on after your running dreams. So we're going to go on and talk about your story. But one of the things that caught my eye first was that you said you won English schools 17 times, or you competed in English schools 17 times.
Yeah.
But either way, that's impressive.
17 times.
Yeah, which is amazing. And, you know, I think I I did like 4 or 5 and I thought that was quite a lot, but 17 is pretty impressive. But regardless, you had, you know, a great career as a runner, and you decided the reason that you kind of initially caught my attention was you moved to Kenya to start training with some of the Run Fast athletes. So maybe you can tell us a bit about why you decided as a British runner to kind of pick up and move everything and move to Kenya.
Yeah, so it was back in around 2010, 2011, and I was working full-time as a chemical engineer. And I think I finished 2009 or 2010, I can't remember, as ranked 4th in the country for the marathon. And with the Olympics, you know, only a few years away, I thought, well, it's not, you know, 3 people can qualify for the Olympics. I'm ranked 4th in the country. It's not a total pipe dream to, you know, to think that I could make the Olympics. And I talked to my coach at the time, Nick Anderson, about what I could do. I said to him, you know, I'm thinking about quitting my job and, you know, moving anywhere to give myself the best chance and opportunity to make the Olympics. And I didn't want to, you know, it come to, you know, later in life and think, oh, if only I'd done this or done that. So I quit my job. And at the same time I was asking Nick, he had bumped into this guy called Peter McHugh, who had just started a management company, a sports management company called Run Fast. And they just opened a new camp in Iten in Kenya. And he was looking for a British athlete that was willing to sort of train the Kenyan way to, you know, to put the full commitment into it, move out and stay on that camp with the Kenyan athletes out there. So it was sort of perfect timing, really. So I went into to London and had a meeting with Peter, and I think he sort of thought that I was the type of guy that could do that, live the really sort of basic lifestyle out there and just dedicate themselves to running and achieving or trying to achieve their goals. So it was on, I think I moved out there on Boxing Day in 2010, flew out to Iten and was met at the airport by this athlete called Edwin Kipyego, who became a really, really good friend of mine, still is a really good friend of mine. We shared a sort of bunk bed for a year, and he went on to run 59:30 for the half marathon and represent Kenya in the world half marathon championships. And yeah, it was an amazing experience. It was so good. I learned so much.
Yeah. Maybe tell us, you know, I'm sure people listening, you know, this is like the ultimate runner dream, to go out there and see what it's like and really give your running career like your absolute best, knowing that you are putting yourself in the best situation. So kind of take us through, like, you know, Edwin met you at the airport, and then what happened from there? And was it what you expected? What was it like?
Well, so the first thing to sort of mention really was that the one thing you have to get used to living out in Kenya is Kenyan time. So they don't really go by normal time. Yeah. So I think I landed at about 4 p.m. So Edwin was, it had all been arranged for him to pick me up. I'd been there about half an hour, still no Edwin, about an hour, and I was getting worried because it was starting to get a bit dark. And so I phoned up Peter McHugh to see if he could contact them, because the numbers I had weren't working. And it basically had just turned out that they were running on Kenyan time, and he turned up sort of, you know, 20 minutes later, and an hour and 20, that's quite, you know, quite normal for the Kenyans to be late. So,
so
I
what
got
does that
used
mean
to that
for that? For anyone who's never heard of that before, it just...
Well, basically, they just turn up when they feel like it. The only time that they are on time is when there's a race and the race starts. Because if they miss the start of the race, then they're not going to earn any money.
Although I have to say, I've been at quite a few races where, like, in the elite section, we are waiting on a few of the Kenyan athletes, and people are like, oh, you know, here comes Kenyan time. Yeah. Like, so even at race situations, I've seen it be kind of a bit frantic because of waiting for a few people.
Yeah, cutting it fine, that's for sure, yeah.
Okay, so then what else did you notice?
Well, so they really, really dedicate themselves to running. That's, people say they run, eat, sleep, and repeat that sort of twice a day, every day. And it's really true. They don't waste energy on anything else. So, you know, in between their runs, they're either just lounging around, you know, maybe doing a bit of light stretching. You know, they don't spend their days running around like, you know, we do when we're sort of working and stuff. Just really making sure they get all the recovery they can between the running. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I really learned was how easy they take their easy runs. Mm-hmm. So it's a real sort of shuffle 10, 12 minute mile pace, you know, when these guys can run, you know, half marathon at, you know, sub 5 minute mile pace easy, mm-hmm. even a marathon at that pace.
So did you find at the beginning you were kind of trying to go a bit faster on the easy days and they were like, no, like come back kind of thing?
Yes. Yeah, a little bit. I think, you know, they were waiting for me a bit on their harder runs because I was getting used to the altitude, and then I was enjoying the easy runs because I could keep up with them, and, you know, was wondering why they were being so slow, but mm-hmm. slowly realized, well, you don't need to run so quick on, you know, whether you're running, if you're running and it's relatively easy at sort of 7 minute mile pace, you might as well run 9-10 minute mile pace, because then you're not going to fatigue yourself. Mm. You're going to get that recovery.
Interesting.
That was really interesting.
Yeah. No, I'm glad to hear that. And then, so, you know, you've kind of said it a little bit that it is just like, you know, eat, run, rest, and kind of repeat, but maybe take us through like a day in the life of, like, what time were you getting up? I'm guessing you didn't drive to where you were going to kind of run. It was just run from where you were, or what did a day in the life of look like?
Yeah. So they generally went with, just before sunrise was the time to get up. They like running nice and early. So we'd get up about 6, pretty much straight out for a run. They didn't eat or drink anything before the normal runs. So say on Monday, it would just be a sort of steady run in the morning. So we'd get up at 6, maybe out for 6:15, and out for like an hour and 20 sort of steady run, maybe up through the forest. Like in Iten, there's endless trails. So you get straight from the door, unless they're doing a more specific tempo run and they want a bit of a flatter route. So sometimes they drove down the valley a little bit to those. But yeah, so they up nice and early, straight out for the run, and then after that back, and then simple breakfast of their really sweet milky tea. They have a lot of sugar in their tea, but and a lot of milk. And so breakfast very simple, maybe some nice fresh fruit like bananas and mangoes, and normally with some bread and jam. And then after that, it's just they sort of sit around chatting, maybe do their washing.
Okay.
You know, they wash everything by hand. That's sort of one of the few sort of chores they have to do. And they like to keep their kit nice and clean, mm-hmm. you know, look after it. Because for most of them, the ones that aren't sponsored, they don't have much.
Yeah.
You know, you see a lot of the guys running around with toes poking out their shoes, you know, and then the ones that are sponsored, they've got, you know, all loads of kit. And then they'll have a nice lunch, normally rice and beans, maybe a nap after lunch, and then go out for the second run of the day about 4 or 5 p.m.
Okay.
And like I said before, that's a nice easy run, 45 minutes to an hour, just sort of real, you know, they'll chat. And then they do their second run of the day, which would be sort of 45 minutes to an hour, nice and easy. They normally wear full track suits for that.
Mm.
I haven't quite figured out why, because it's normally quite hot at 4 or 5.
Like, how hot are we talking here?
Well, because it's quite high altitude, it's never like really, really hot, but maybe sort of 25 degrees. And the sun Celsius is very size. Strong up there. Yeah, Celsius, yeah. But they wear their full track suits. And I just think they like to do that. So when it comes down to the harder stuff or the racing, they sort of, then they're down to the sort of, you know, just the vest and shorts, and they feel the benefit.
Mm-hmm. And then what was bedtime?
So they'd normally have quite a late dinner. So sunset is at about 6 p.m. And then maybe they'd have dinner at about 8:30, 9 o'clock. Wow. Okay. And then straight after dinner, they'd go to bed.
Okay.
So they liked to have their dinner just before bed, because, and they said to me the reason, because I didn't like to do that, because I like to sort of digest my food a bit I went to bed. But they said the reason they did that was so that they had more energy in the morning.
Okay.
I'm not sure that quite worked, but, you know, it worked for them, so.
Yep. Okay, cool. And then, so what was the biggest, you know, were there any aspects that you kind of, you know, maybe you weren't what you expected and you kind of struggled with, or did you kind of slot in pretty easily to what life was like?
I did slot in quite easy with sort of lifestyle. It was nice for a while. I think the biggest challenge after a while was coming from, you know, working a full-time job to going to doing nothing but running. And
yes.
I struggled, you know, not having too much sort of mentally engaging mm-hmm. in my sort of day-to-day life. I did a small blog at the time, which was something.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a bit of a struggle. In terms of the running, I really liked the routine.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't too far different from what I'd been doing. The mileage was about the same. I was used to high mileage. The altitude was a real, that was the biggest challenge of it, of anything.
Mm-hmm.
So ITIM was 2,400 meters, which is like 8,000 feet.
Wow, yeah.
I acclimatized to a certain extent, probably in the first 6 weeks, and mm-hmm. then just plateaued and never... I mean, I think it would have taken probably 5 years of living there constantly to, you know, for it to become sort of normal.
Mm-hmm.
So every run, whenever you hit a hill, it was always hurt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was always out of breath, you know, well, way past the hill.
So then how about with them to you? Like, how did they kind of treat you? Was it you accepted in straight away, or was it kind of a bit skeptical, or are they used to having people around? How was that part of it?
Well, they were very accepting of me. It was really nice because mm-hmm. I was obviously, you know, quite sort of apprehensive and nervous about going in there. And the day that I arrived, it had been a long travel and we mm-hmm. arrived late at night and I met everyone on camp and we all squeezed into this small room and had dinner together.
Mm-hmm.
And I was exhausted and just sort of had to ask them where my bed was so I could go to bed. But they were just really, they were brilliant. And I think because of the times I'd run, so, you know, I'd run 64 for half and 217 for marathon, which was actually quicker than half of them had run because they only run in Kenya.
Mm.
So straight away, I got that respect of being an athlete.
Mm-hmm.
And then they saw that I was, you know, running with them every day, doing exactly what they were doing. And more sometimes, because one of the things that the Kenyans do, if they're feeling a bit sort of extra tired, they will... happily take of an extra rest afternoon.
Oh, really?
But yeah, which was really, you know, they a lot of them are very in tune with their body
mm-hmm.
in terms of they know when they're a bit, you know, too tired and need that extra rest, which is really good. And I mean, through all the years I've been running, I haven't got that. You know, if I've got a training program, I stick to it.
I think we're all guilty of that over here.
I think so, yeah, which was really interesting. So they saw me out there every day, I'd be doing all the runs, and you gain the respect.
Mm-hmm.
So that was brilliant. It was really nice.
Yeah. And so was it just the once you went out there, or how many times was this like an often?
No, I mean, I was there for a year,
mm-hmm.
but I mean, I came back to sort of race, but I was sort of, I would say I was living there for a year.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a long, you know, good amount of time.
Yeah. And then, so what happened when you did go back home to race?
Well, so it was really interesting. I think for me, it was such a, there was a lot of changes, even though the training was similar, it was still running. I think the diet changed a bit because I'd become a full-time athlete. It sort of maybe changed my outlook on running.
Okay.
And the altitude, I think, was probably the biggest thing. So my first stint out there, I was there for 3 months and then I came back to do a half marathon, the CPC half marathon in The Hague.
Okay.
Which is where I'd run my PB sort of a year or two before. And I had high hopes. I really thought I was in PB shape because before I'd flown out to Kenya, I'd done a half marathon, I'd run 65. So I knew I was in good shape. And then I'd been there training for 3 months, like, and I'd seen improvements in my training, even though they were all at altitude, you know, mm-hmm. I'd got quicker week in, week out mm-hmm. there in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back and I did this half marathon. I ran 70 or 71.
Wow.
And I just was like, what's going on? I just couldn't understand it.
Do you think any of that was the expectation? Kind of like, oh, I did all that. I went all the way over there. I did everything they said. I have to kind of prove myself. Was any of that part of that, do you think?
I'm not sure about having to prove myself, maybe to myself, because I'd quit my job and become this full-time athlete, that maybe I'd put that extra pressure on myself to do that. And there was also the Kenyan optimism. So they are the most optimistic people in the world, and it's brilliant. So, you know, whatever happens, you know, if they have a bad race or drop out, they'll say, it's fine, it doesn't matter, I'll win next time. And they really do not dwell on it at all.
Wow.
So, but they've been telling me, oh, it's all right. You know, you've run 64 and 217. You've trained in Kenya. You're going to run easy run 62 and 212 just because you've been in Kenya. I was like, but they kept telling me. So I was like, well, this is brilliant. I'm going to run really quick. And maybe one thing, I probably went off too quick because I had that. And I'd come down from altitude the first time. So the first couple of K in the half felt really easy, like running about sort of 250 per K. But the thing, like looking back on it, because I was not used to this, to the altitude training, I hadn't run quicker than 3 minutes per kilometer for more than, you know, one or two, you know, a few reps on the track. So my, you know, maybe cardiovascularly I was in really good shape, but my legs just weren't used to running that quick for an extended amount of time. And even worse, when I stepped up to the marathon and tried to run sort of 2:15 or quicker, my legs just, the longest I'd run out in Kenya at my predicted or my marathon goal pace was about 15 minutes. So when you look back on it, it's quite obvious you're not going to run that time if you've only run for 15 minutes at that pace.
Which I think actually is the problem with a lot of people, you know, across the board, all the way, whatever time you've run, you know, whatever level you're at. You know, if you do go off too fast and you do push it too early when your body isn't used to it, you know, people often say to me like, oh, why did I get a cramp at mile 20, or I hit the wall, or I'm really struggling. And it's because you're, you know, like you said, your body isn't prepared. You hadn't prepared it correctly or done enough to be able to handle that, especially that early in the race. So I think that's good for people to hear you say that. And so after that, you went back to Kenya, and then did you come back again?
Yeah. So I went back to Kenya, and then so I started, once I'd realized that, you know, what was happening, I tried to alter the training so that I could run for longer at the marathon pace that I wanted to do. So I'd find flatter courses or courses that were slightly downhill. So I had this one in Iten that was about 11 or 12k slightly downhill, and I could run all of that at my, you know, my marathon pace. And then I'd take longer recoveries when I was on the track, so I could actually hit the paces that I wanted to, rather than just, you know, doing the entire session with the group, but running really quite slow in reality. So, you know, altering things, and that did make a difference. But I think two things that I did wrong. First of all, was that because I'd become a full-time athlete, something changed for me when before I just ran because I love to run. And, you know, I would happily be running sort of 140 miles a week whilst working a full-time job because I loved it. And I loved doing the training, and there wasn't any pressure because I was working full-time. And then I went to Kenya and I was a full-time athlete, and I'd had a few disappointing results, and then the pressure built. And I started waking up and thinking, oh, I have to go for this run, and I don't really want to. And then so the enjoyment went. And when you don't enjoy running, there's no way you're going to run fast. Well, so I you know.
No, that I'm so glad you mentioned that. And I mean, you don't know this, Tom, but most people who are listening are going to know that, you know, I have stopped running. I stopped running 10 weeks ago. And that was kind of the same thing. I had kind of got to the point where I wasn't enjoying it. And like you said, it got to the point of like, I have to run. And so I've started to focus on getting my health back and finding that love for running again. So I think it's really important that you mention that, because I think people often think that there's this like dream of like, you know, the ultimate runner dream is to be able to live. And, you know, for everyday recreational athletes, they think, oh, you know, if I could live like that, it'd be the best life ever. But you've kind of demonstrated it. And I never had any desire to just be a full-time athlete because of that exact reason.
Yeah.
So I think it's important that you mentioned that you did it, and you kind of are showing that it's not necessarily the best thing for you. And so if you could go back now, would you, do you think you would have done this again? Was it something you feel like you had to learn, or would you have probably just stayed at your job and kind of kept going?
I would do it again, because even though that happened, it was one of the best experiences of my life. Mm-hmm. I loved it. I loved the people. I loved so much about it. It was a shame that I lost the love for running at that
mm-hmm.
time.
Mm-hmm.
I did get it back later, but I would do it again. I would probably change things. It's hard. I'm not sure what I would change. But I would do it again.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And so you said you got it back. How did you get your love for running back? For anyone who is listening and maybe is in that rut where they're like stuck, and, you know, my reason was for like medical reasons as well, but for someone who doesn't want to stop running and they just kind of want to find their passion, what brought it back for you?
Well, so after I had come back, I think I'd run London Marathon and it hadn't gone very well, and I decided not to go back to Kenya to get a job again, because I retired. I said, that's it. I've had enough of running. And so I stopped running for about a month. I got a job at Runfast in London. Mm-hmm. So I was still involved in running. I still knew that, you know, running was sort of a big part of my life. I wanted to sort of give back from all the experiences I had, and becoming a sort of sports agent.
Mm-hmm.
Was great, because I could give back to these guys in Kenya, give them opportunities to earn money. So that was great.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of running, so I retired. I think I hadn't run for about a month. And then I started feeling like unfit. And it was, you know, one of the first times or few times in my life when I sort of felt unfit. And so I thought, well, let's just start running just to get a bit of fitness back.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just, you know, went out a couple of times a week. Just, you know, 30 minutes, but I only did it when I felt like it.
Mm.
So I'd wake up, look outside. Oh, it's a nice day today. I'll go out for a run. And wake up the next day. Oh, it's raining. I'm not going to
I was going to say, in England, you probably only did get the opportunity for 2 days if you were taking it that way.
Yeah. So after a few weeks of that, or maybe a month of running two or three times a week, I was like, well, that's okay. You know, I'm enjoying every time I go out, and I'm feeling a bit fit. I'm feeling better because of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it had scaled back from running, or, you know, training sort of 12 times a week to two or three times. And then there was a few people that ran in the mornings, and I asked if I could join them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started running most mornings, and then there was people to run with.
Yeah.
So that was really nice. So it was just, then it became a bit of a social thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we were just running and chatting. There was no pressures to run any particular speed,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, you're getting fitter.
Yeah.
So then before I knew, I was running sort of, probably every day, you know, maybe, you know, having one day off a week, but just enjoying every run. And I realized then that I wanted to run, but I wanted to make sure that I just enjoyed it. And, you know, to this day, I always keep that in my mind, that you run because you love it.
Yeah.
You don't do it. If it ever becomes, you know, that doing it because you have to do it, then it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
Step it back again. Mm-hmm. Luckily, that hasn't happened.
Well, that's good. And I think it's because you've kept that right, you know, frame of mind, really. And I think everyone listening, you can kind of keep that same thing. You know, if it does get to that point, scale back, maybe take some time off. And then, like Tom said, start again. And you mentioned, you know, a job was a big part of this. And you said about Runfast management. And tell us about, what is a manager at Runfast? What does that involve?
So it involves recruiting athletes, finding athletes' races, and negotiating sort of deals with races.
Mm-hmm.
And once they're organized, then you have to organize athletes' visas, sort of travel, accommodation.
So this is worldwide athletes?
It is worldwide.
Okay.
At Runfast, because it was quite a new company, it was sort of, and it started in Kenya. Then it was primarily Kenyans, but then we had some Ugandans and a few Ethiopians, and also, and now more so, British athletes.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was there, it was mainly the Kenyans and Ugandans. I spent some time in Uganda, which was really good.
Mm-hmm.
So it involved going out to Kenya and maybe going to races out there and trying to sort of find some sort of young upcoming talent.
What would you look for? Just like the times they've run, or like a certain, like a smooth running form? Like, or I guess most Kenyan runners have a smooth running form.
Oh, so. Not all of them. But oh, really? Yeah, a lot of, yeah, there's some that have got crazy form. But in general, if you're coming in the sort of top 10 in a race in Kenya, especially around sort of, you know, Iten Eldoret area, this is so competitive that if you're coming in the top 10, then you're pretty good. So normally if they're not signed to any manager, then you'd speak to them. And if they haven't sort of raced abroad before, then maybe you could get them to go and train with the group. So training with people like Edwin Kipyego, who you know is very good. Mm-hmm. And if they're looking good in the group for a week or two, then they're probably worth signing and giving an opportunity. Mm. And so for athletes who haven't had the opportunity to race abroad, then a race won't pay for their flights or anything. So a management company like Run Fast would sort of sponsor the athlete to come to the UK and do a series of races, hopefully win enough money to pay back the flights and the costs of the visas, and then make enough money that they can take some home. And also the other side of that is to run fast enough times so that races maybe in Europe or other places in the world are interested in, first of all, paying for their flights, and then once they've run even faster, then giving them appearance fees.
Okay.
Things like that.
And so what are some of the hardest or like most stressful parts of a job like that?
It's, I mean, it's really quite stressful at times because, you know, obviously you're dealing with people that live very sort of remotely in Kenya, and they can be, you know, when you're based in London, for instance, then you don't know what they're up to all the time.
Okay.
In terms of their training, like you could plan a race for them in April and they could be in their best shape in January for the cross countries. And then it becomes to April and then, you know, they're sort of overtrained. So maybe, you know, and then they can come to the races and not perform particularly well and not even earn enough money to pay the flights back. So it can become, you know, quite stressful. And then there's, you know, you've got to make, maybe you've got 10, 15 athletes racing in four or five different countries on one weekend.
Oh, wow.
You know, and the logistics of that can be quite tricky. You know, and you sometimes get phone calls in the middle of the night because of the time differences saying, oh, I've missed my flight. What can you do? And you've got to sort that sort of thing out.
Okay. Okay. Interesting to hear about. And then how do you kind of walk the line between getting the appearance fees for money, helping them to make money to take back to their family, and getting them to good races where they can race well? How do you kind of walk that line between doing that and racing people too much? Because, you know, I've seen it time and time again, at least here in America, where I'll see the same runners turn up at race after race, weekend after weekend, and they kind of said, you know, they're exhausted but they're still going. Like, how do you stop people like abusing them, or like, have, did you see any of that?
Yeah, I definitely saw that with other management companies. There's a lot of good management companies out there, and there's some not so good ones that I guess they need to earn money themselves, and so they see the athletes more as a way of them making money than people, which is not good. I know that Peter McHugh came in it from a total point of trying to give these guys the opportunity to earn money and develop them. You know, the perfect example for Runfast is Edwin. I've mentioned Edwin Kipyego. So when they got him, he'd run 64 minutes for a half marathon. You know, then he went to 62 in the UK, which gave him the opportunity to run in Europe, where he ran 61, and then he started getting the appearance fees, and then in the fast races, he won them, ran 60, and then all the way until he ran, you know, the sub 60. And so it's just about being really careful, getting them the balance between running fast. So some races you'll say, right, okay, this one, maybe he won't win, maybe he or she won't win, but more than like, it's a really good opportunity to run a fast time. Once they've got the fast time, there's more opportunity to earn some money. So, you know, getting the balance, giving them enough time in advance to plan their training. And probably the good thing is being, you know, when I was doing the job, I was an athlete myself.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's good for an athlete, you know, if you give them, you know, four half marathons in 4 weeks, that's not a good racing schedule, and you know, by the last two they're going to be knackered, and probably get injured, and that's not good for anyone.
Do you think a lot of the reason you were able to kind of look at it like that was because you did go out there and kind of saw how dedicated everyone is and how you kind of experienced it yourself, so you could kind of keep that in mind when figuring this out? Whereas, you know, some of the other managers may be so far detached from it that they forget that they're that it's actual people you're dealing with.
Yeah, I definitely. The main reason I did that job was to give these guys opportunities. That I love that about the job. Mm-hmm. And, you know, having lived there, and even before the year I was there, before I was the manager, you know, they were always asking me, oh, when am I going to get a race, or, you know, what race is and all this. And, you know, so I saw how desperate they were, but also I could see it from both sides.
Yeah.
So I could see it from being an athlete and seeing it from being a manager. And mm-hmm. that really helped. It really helped.
Yeah, definitely.
And also, when I was the manager, all the athletes knew that I was also an athlete. So they knew that I understood. So they had trust in me that I'd do the right thing for them.
No, that makes total sense. And it's funny, when you were talking about Edwin, I just realized the day before I ran London Marathon 2015, I actually ran with Edwin. And
brilliant.
The day before the race, I was running with Tom Craggs, who we both know.
Yeah.
And I remember there was a guy running behind us, and he was kind of, you know, about 20 meters behind us. And we kept turning around, and Tom was like, hey, do you want to run with us? And he was like, okay. So he like came and ran with us, and we ran along, and we ended up taking a photo. So I have that. And then he said, I think he was pacing. Yeah.
He was. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just funny, what a small world. And when you first said his name, I thought, that seems familiar, it just dawned on me when you said that. So that's really funny. Small world. So then, one other question that I was curious about when it comes to this is, being a manager, you know, we're hearing more and more of these stories about doping, and especially Kenyan athletes coming up with this. So how do you stop your athletes, or like being that manager, how do you stop them going down that route? And like, what do people put in place now to kind of make sure they know that this isn't like a good thing to be doing?
That's a really interesting question. It's obviously tough being a manager and trying to keep control of that, because mm-hmm. you're not there all the time. And, you know, I'm glad to see that there's starting to do out of competition testing in Kenya, because previously that was never done. And I still think that it needs to be done a lot more,
mm-hmm.
but that's obviously not the managers doing that. Some managers, I think, have started doing some testing, which is really good. But it's obviously very expensive, and you don't make a lot of money managing athletes.
Yeah.
So it's hard to do that. I guess education is one thing, telling the athletes, you know, if they're ill, that before they take any medicine, that they should check it with the manager to make sure it's not on the banned list. Any, they like to take supplements out there.
Like what kind of supplements?
Multivitamins.
Okay.
They're crazy about multivitamins. I don't know where they've got that from, but they're really crazy about it. But if they were doing that, then even with those, you know, you need to, you know, if they're buying them in Kenya, they could be sort of contaminated with something. So being really careful and making sure anything that they're taking, as any professional athlete should do, is being really careful, educating them, and also having a very hard line on any offenders. So mm-hmm. I know at Run Fast, they have a policy where they don't sign any people that have previously served any doping bans. You know, so there is, at this time, I guess there's only so much you can do, but it is a problem, mm-hmm. and there needs to be more steps taken, I think.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it continues to move in the right direction.
I really hope so.
And then one other thing I wanted to ask you about just before we wrap up here is, from what I read, you are the Wings for Life world champion. And, you know, I've only heard about this race in the last few months, but I just think it's such a cool idea. So maybe you could tell people what that is and what does being the winner involve?
Well, I didn't win the world title, but I did win Wings for Life twice. So it's a brilliant concept. So the concept, it's a Red Bull charity. So Wings for Life is a Red Bull charity, and it's for spinal cord injury and mm-hmm. spinal cord research. So the Wings for Life race, basically you start running, and there's about 30 locations around the world, and they all start at the same time. So you're not only racing the people in your country, you're racing the people around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And 30 minutes after you start, a catcher car starts driving at a set speed. And then when that car catches you, your race is over. So different than normal races. In a normal race, the faster you run, the quicker you finish. Yeah. In the Wings for Life race, the quicker you run, the further you run. So the fastest person is the last person to finish.
So what's the trick with doing well? Is it kind of saving your energy to...
Pace judgment, yeah. Really. They're quite good. On the website, they have a goal calculator.
Okay.
So you can sort of work out roughly how far, if you think you can run 4 minutes per kilometer, which sort of was up my sort of goal, you make it about 65 kilometers before you get caught.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can sort of play around with this goal calculator and then you can, you know, work out roughly how far you can go.
Mm-hmm. And how far did you make it?
Well, the first year I did it, which was 2 years ago, at Silverstone, I made it 61 kilometres or 63 kilometres, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Before it was David Coulthard was driving the catch car. So that was quite cool. Quite good fun. And then the prize, if you win your country, is 2 tickets to any of the other races in the world for the following year.
Oh.
So I took my girlfriend Rachel to Brazil last year.
Wow.
The race was in Brasilia, which was really good fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I was lucky enough to win that one as well. So this year, a couple of weeks ago, we went to Norway.
Wow.
And unfortunately, I didn't win that one. I'd done London Marathon 2 weeks before and then the Hackney Half the week after London, which was the week before, and I was just, my legs are a bit
tired.
Surprised. And also I've got the World Ultra Trail Running Championships in 3 weeks. So I didn't really want to totally wreck myself. So I thought maybe I'll just run to like 50K and then be sensible and not kill myself. Mm-hmm. So I just did 50K this year.
Mm-hmm. Well, cool.
But it was a nice trip to Norway, yeah.
And why would you encourage someone to do that over a typical, you know, let's say they're looking at maybe a half marathon or something? Why would they? Why do that one?
It's something different, and that's always good fun. And also, 100% of the entry fees goes to the Wings for Life charity.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the last couple of years that they made about 6 or 8 million euros for the charity.
Mm-hmm.
So you can have a really good event. It's really good fun. It's different.
Mm-hmm.
And you can also, you know, raise money for a good cause.
Yeah, so that's awesome. Really cool. Well, I will put links in the show notes for anyone. If you are interested in the Wings for Life run, I know quite a few people who are listening to this have done it, but I encourage anyone else. And that is going to be at tinamuir.com/episode11. All right, we are just going to take a moment to thank our sponsor. We will be right back with the Running for Real for... I may have stopped running, but one of my favorite sponsors still makes its way into my food every day. Generation Youcan. You probably already know I'm a huge fan of Youcan. No, I used it as my sole fuel source in my 2:36 marathon. And yes, I was a little bit scared I would bonk, but my energy levels felt exactly the same the entire way. I didn't have those ups and downs, the sugar highs and sugar lows that gels gave me. But maybe you're thinking, yeah, Tina likes Youcan, but what is it? Well, Youcan is a carbohydrate source originally created for a little boy named Jonah, who continually had low blood sugar. Years later, Youcan is a favourite amongst many elites, including everyone's favourite, Meb Keplezgi. Youcan is giving Running For Real listeners 10% off using code RUNNINGFORREAL. So check out generationyoucan.com for more about Youcan and learn how it can help you control your blood sugar, fuel your races, and maybe make those bottomless pit stomachs of ours be happy for just a little bit longer post-run. Okay, so we're just going to go on to the Running for Real 4. So Tom, maybe start with a unique nutrition tip, maybe something you learned in Kenya, if there's something applicable.
Okay, well, probably two things with this. So in Kenya, they've got a very simple diet. It's quite plant-based. They eat a lot of fresh fruit and vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And they have their national dish, which is ugali, which is maize flour, which quite a few people have heard of. Generally, they'll eat sort of meat once or twice a week.
Okay.
So, you know, not that much, but it's like lots of beans and, like I said, vegetables and fresh fruit.
Okay.
And so I was eating that whilst I was out there, which was really good.
Mm-hmm.
And then probably 18 months ago, I became vegan. And so it just a sort of maybe slight extension from what I was doing in Kenya, of, you know, just cutting out that little bit of meat they were having.
Mm-hmm.
And I've really found these last 18 months, I got my first GB vest and my second GB vest. Mm-hmm. And I really think my diet has a big part of that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool. Yeah, thank you for sharing. Okay, and then how about a running for real moment, you know, a moment where you struggled, you're embarrassed, or something that really showed, like, being a, you know, what a runner really involves.
Okay, mm-hmm. Well, so as we've been talking about Kenya, well, so when I first got to Kenya, there was a race on in Iten. It was the Iten District Cross Country Championships.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what a great opportunity, you know, like, let's jump in a race in Kenya and, you know, give it a go. And it was a 12K cross country, six laps of 2K. And so I had two aims in this race. The first one was not to get lapped. And the second one was not to come last.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'd gone into this, I was ranked fourth, you know, fourth marathon runner in the UK. So I thought I was in a decent runner. But I only achieved one of those goals because I got lapped by Jeffrey Mutai,
oh, wow,
who went on. Yeah. And that was just before he ran the 2-3 in Boston. So that was okay. And I thought I was going to come last because every time I overtook a Kenyan, they dropped out. I think they didn't want the Mzungu, as they, you know, to beat them. But luckily, coming down the home straight, there was one guy sort of struggling a bit, and I managed to sprint past him and I think finished second from last. So that was a real sort of eye opener for me,
yeah,
you know, coming second from last in a race.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah, I bet that was a humbling moment. And then what about a high moment for you?
Well, I mean, probably my sort of best moment in running was I started running when I joined my local club when I was 9 or 10. Mm-hmm. And even when I was quite young, sort of under 15 age group, I always had that dream of running for GB, you know, whether it was the Olympics or whatever, but it was always looking for that GB vest. And it took me 25 years of hard work before I finally got it. So that was a long time coming, but it was well worth the wait to finally.
And which race was it?
So last year I ran in the World Ultra Trail Running Championships.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I want to know what's so funny about that. Again, you don't know the story. Tom and I, we haven't really spoken in the past, but everyone listening will already know this, that the reason I was able to step away from running, the reason I talked over and over again, everyone listening who is a regular listener of this podcast, Tom, my ultimate number one goal was to have that GB vest in my hand.
Yeah.
And I did it last year. And,
amazing,
you know, it's so funny hearing you say that, especially being another British athlete, people listening, like you guys are really hearing right now, that is like the ultimate goal for, you know, almost every British runner is to, and the same thing. I mean, I started at really kind of running properly at like 14, but again, I said, it was 14 years of hard work and struggle to get that GB vest in my hands. So it's just kind of so funny hearing you say that, because people who are regular listeners know how much that meant to me. And, you know, your high moment is exactly the same as mine. So that's really
cool.
all right. And then, so what do you tell yourself when you're standing on the start line?
Well, a lot of the time when I'm standing on the start line, I say to myself, what am I doing here? I always have those sort of, you know, like worries and stuff. But, you know, after I get over that, it's normally, you know, realizing or looking back at all the hard work you put in. And, mm-hmm, you know, that's sort of why you're there,
mm-hmm,
like why you do all that training. You know, if that's what you love doing, if you love the racing, then that's why you do all the training. So standing on that start line, that's, you know, you've put in all the hard work, now it's time to reap the benefits.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I have all my guests send me a photo of them doing the R4R power pose, which is your pose you would do, you know, in the starting area to kind of build confidence, you know, like mine is my hand on my hips. Will you send us a photo of you doing your power pose, what you would do before a race to kind of build that confidence in yourself?
Yeah, sure, definitely.
Okay, great. All right. Well, Tom, thank you so much. This was so interesting and I really enjoyed this interview. I'm sure people will be following along with your journey. What would be the best way for them to find you in the future?
So the best way to find me, so myself and my girlfriend, Rachel, we've set up our own business called Run Namaste Eat.
So we're on Facebook, okay. Run Namaste, and we do trail running and yoga retreats.
Oh, cool.
So look for us on that, and you can find us in the mountains somewhere.
Okay. I will put links in the show notes. And which mountains are you referring to if someone decides to scour some mountains for you?
Well, we're in Chamonix at the moment, so the Alps, but we visit the Atlas Mountains in Morocco and Kenya as well.
Wow, so, cool. Awesome. Yeah. Sounds like a great opportunity. And thank you so much for your time and for sharing your story with us. It's been great.
Thank you.
Wasn't that interesting? I have always wondered what it would be like to kind of live as a Kenyan runner. And now we got the inside story and we got to see the other side of things through the management end of it. And I thought that was really interesting. And I'm really glad that he was kind of honest and open with everything about that situation. Tom has his world championship race next weekend. So wishing him lots of luck. And I hope you will send him a message of good luck as well. So next Wednesday, June 7th is National Running Day. So I have a special episode lined up for you with one of the members of Team Ice Cream. I'm not going to tell you which one it is. You'll have to wait to find out, but that will come out on Wednesday. So make sure if you haven't already subscribed to this podcast on your podcast app, on Stitcher, on Google Play, or whoever else, whatever podcast catcher app you listen to, make sure you have subscribed so that goes straight to you on June 7th. But it will be with a member of Team Ice Cream, and it's a really good one. You are going to love it. So just a reminder that the marathon and half marathon training plans are now live on tinamuir.com. And we have a 40 to 50 and 60 to 70 mile per week plan. But anyone who is panicking, thinking, I can't run that. When I say 40 to 50 or 60 to 70, I don't mean you'll start there. I mean, we will build up to those mileages during the segment. And it's not going to be like a big jump. You're going to take your time to getting up there, and you can stay on either end of the scale. But if you want to know more information, you can go to visit the show notes for this episode, which is at tinamuir.com/episode11. And there is also a video on there to show you how to subscribe and how to leave a rating and review. So I would really appreciate if you could go check that out. And I want to thank you so much for listening, for spending some time with me and Tom today. And next episode is a surprise, so I'm not going to tell you who it is. It is a member of Team Ice Cream, but you'll have to wait to find out. Have a great week.
Thanks for listening to the Running for Real podcast. Be sure to check out tinamuir.com for show notes and even more helpful running information.